Hi everyone, my name is Chris Deasy, and it was fantastic to catch up for my latest nostalgia interview with Penny Sartori. I knew Penny in the late 1990s when we were both doing PhDs at Lampeter. Penny is a medical researcher and teacher in the field of near-death experiences. And Penny used to work in the intensive therapy unit in Morriston Hospital in Swansea. And this led her to want to research more about what happens when we die. Something that Penny discovered is that the neurophysiological assumptions that better fitted her nurse training didn't seem to be sufficient for understanding the phenomena of NDEs. She found that talking to patients about what they were feeling and what they said to her face-to-face was an eye-opening experience. The patients appreciated the fact that she was taking their experiences seriously, whereas in many cases their relatives might dismiss their testimonies. So it was a form of empowerment for them, which counterbalanced the trauma of having come close to death. Penny talks about the negative experiences which some of the patients had. She reveals what her colleagues in the nursing profession thought about her research and the importance for nurses to recognise and validate these experiences and support their patients. We learned how all of this ended up becoming the PhD, which she did with Paul Badham, and how this all changed her life. Her work has enabled her to become more appreciative of her life, and it taught her to live in the moment. We talk about the characteristics of a near-death experience, the findings of her research. We find that she is interested in the extent to which NDEs give meaning to the lives of her patients. And Penny discusses the lack of acceptance in nursing circles of these experiences. Penny tells me about the impact of her research and the book which followed, which was serialised in a national newspaper. We find out what made her enter the nursing profession in the first place and how everything has fallen into place in her life subsequently. Then towards the end of the interview, Penny talks about growing up in Swansea, where she used to enjoy going surfing. We hear about her love of 80s music. We learn that she is in touch with her best friend from school, why she enjoyed the solitude of lockdown, and we discover why Penny is a looking forward kind of person. It was a huge thrill after so many years to catch up with Penny Sartori for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is an absolute pleasure this afternoon to have Penny Sartori as my latest nostalgia interview guest. And Penny, of course, we knew each other, we were just saying before we started recording, about 23 years ago, I'm guessing it must have been.
Yeah, that's right. Gosh, it seems like yesterday. It really does.
Well, and it's really funny because obviously I've interviewed other Lampeter former staff and students as well. But I'm always conscious how much I'm channeling both in some cases, the people like Paul Badham, who obviously was your PhD supervisor, but also the content of the work that I was doing. And of course, in your case, it's the very empirically based work on near-death experiences that actually made you do it. You were doing a very exciting PhD project and a contemporary of mine. And so it's a real pleasure to have you to talk about your work today.
Oh, it's nice to be here, Chris. Yeah.
Well, do you want to say a little bit how the journey started for you? Because from memory, and obviously you can correct me, but as I recall, you were working as a nurse in one of the hospitals in Swansea, and you were working in the critical injury unit. Is that right?
Yes, I was working in ITU, the intensive therapy unit, and that's really what got me into this research because I'd never really heard of near-death experiences, and I was looking after a man who was dying, and it really upset me. I made a connection with this man, and it was something that really made me think about death. And I thought, what happens? What is death that bad that we have to put patients through everything to prevent their death when it's inevitable? And I really got quite upset about this patient who was clearly dying and we weren't letting him die. So he did eventually die, but that was something that upset me so much. It made me a little bit depressed, but I started reading about death then, and, you know, anything I could find on death, I'd read. And then I came across near-death experiences, and I thought, oh, wow, this sounds really fascinating. These people who have had a close brush with death might have had a cardiac arrest, so, you know, they might have died temporarily and been resuscitated. They were describing a wonderful experience that was peaceful, ecstatic, where they would meet deceased relatives or friends. And when they came back to life, it had a profound impact on the way in which they lived their life. So that kind of really got me curious. And because my nurse training was very scientific, it was sort of, I thought it must be some sort of hallucination. There's got to be a neurophysiological explanation for this. So the more I kind of read about these experiences, the more curious I became. And I just thought, well, I'm working in a perfect place to study this. And so I just decided to undertake my own research. And that was the motivator for it, really. But I don't know, I think that had such a profound effect on me that I just wanted to find out more about this phenomenon, you know. So it completely, I became obsessed with it, really, and it took up all of my time, but it wasn't like it was any arduous task at all. It was really enjoyable, and I was enjoying every minute of it, you know. And yeah, the way it all came about, just, it was like something magical, the way it all happened as well.
Yeah, it sounds like that sort of sense of counterpoint, because you know, if there's a driver for anything, and it, you know, for example, a PhD, and we'll obviously come on to that in a moment, but if there's something that is really chipping away at you, then it's not work. And that's why I think, actually, and ironically, in a profession like ours, sometimes the concept of holidays is very interesting, because it's not, you know, sometimes holiday actually means the chance to do the things that you don't get the chance to do during your normal period. So it's like, you know, it's like the old Tony Benn adage, he gave up being an MP in order to devote more time to politics. It kind of feels like that. But that sort of labour of love, I think, is a really interesting way of looking at it, because, and I find it with my own students, if you're interested or concerned about the big existential ultimate life and death questions, then you're not going to just sort of be looking at the clock in the lecture theatre and say, oh, I can't wait for this to end so I can go on to do something else. You know, the journey and the philosophising and the theology that's going on there is something that obviously takes you beyond the particular lecture theatre or the task of writing an essay that you might be involved with.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It was just, the whole thing was just so enjoyable. I was just totally immersed in it and engrossed in it, and never once did I feel, oh, I can't wait for this to finish and I can't wait to finish my PhD. I never felt that at all. It was, to be honest with you, I'd never done it to gain a qualification anyway. It was just a means to exploring something I was really interested in. And, you know, if I'm honest, when I did start my PhD, I didn't really know what a PhD was. And I think perhaps if I did know what it would have been about, I wouldn't have applied to do it in the first place, you know. But it did take a long time. But all of that time, it was just really enjoyable, the whole 8 years, because it took, or 7 years to complete it. So I did it part-time. So I just thoroughly enjoyed it.
And it's interesting, really, because when you were doing the PhD, as I recall, it kind of, what you were doing encapsulated the very kind of thing that I wasn't doing, which was empirical research, in the sense that I was doing my stuff on film, and that was great. And I suppose, yes, I suppose I was actually watching films and going to the cinema and dealing with audience and critical sort of reception. And so there was that element to it. But you know, the study of death and the afterlife in the MA that I did before the PhD was very theoretically grounded. And that was a safe space, so you could read and reflect and look at what the great authors and the great theologians and philosophers through the ages have said. But when I met you, and I learned that you were dealing with, you know, real life people, and that your job couldn't be more sort of empirically grounded, it was a real eye opener, because it was suddenly apparent that you weren't just going to come to, and you know, in a lot of PhDs, you can come to any sort of conclusion. You can manipulate the evidence or whatever, or the data, to suit your argument. But in your case, you were dealing with real people, and obviously there are all sort of ethical issues around that in terms of data that you're able to access. So in that sense, I think what you were doing was something really quite phenomenal.
Yeah, and it was really fascinating as well, you know, because actually hearing exactly what these patients were feeling and what they'd experienced, and having that opportunity to talk to them face to face about it was really eye-opening for me. But it was also beneficial for the patients as well, because it was like, wow, someone's listening, someone's actually taking me seriously. And very often they wanted me to go back and speak with them, because they had so much to say about this experience. They wanted to talk about it constantly, but they were finding that if they talked about it to their relatives didn't understand it. And they very often people were kind of dismissing it and saying, oh, it was all those drugs and things, which wasn't helpful to them in trying to understand what had happened to them. So it was really helpful to them, but it was also really helpful to me as well, to my research. So it was a two-way thing, really. And, you know, I developed really good relationships with those patients as well, because I was able to follow them up as well then intermittently after their experience.
And I suppose the question that I'm sure you're always asked, which also I guess was also the nature of the PhD, which was whether your findings, your conclusions matched what you perhaps hoped or expected to encounter when you began the project.
Yeah, I don't know whether they did or not, because I never really, I thought, you know, maybe I'll get some answers as to, you know, what really happens when we die. But even after speaking with all these people and having a good idea about what people experience in the time leading up to death, I think the only time we're ever going to know for certain is when we experience that in its entirety at our own death as well. So we can have an idea from what people have actually experienced, but I think the only time we're going to be certain about it is when we die ourselves.
Yeah, and I'm really interested in the way that you said that the work you were doing had a transformative effect and impact on the patients. So it wasn't just that they were, obviously you were benefiting from the testimony that they were giving you, but also the fact that you were listening to them and taking them seriously. I'm guessing that there must be particular individuals that have really stuck with you and their particular narrative and the trauma as well, I'm guessing. Yeah. Or was it trauma? That's the question, because of course that most NDEs I know tend to be more positive than negative. Obviously there's a small number that are traumatic, but was that your experience as well?
Yeah, well, it was two different things, because it was a traumatic experience as to how they'd ended up in intensive care. So there was that side of things, but the actual experience itself was often a source of empowerment for them, and it gave them a different perspective on everything. And that kind of was such an overwhelming perspective for them that they gained, that kind of counterbalanced that original trauma as to why they were there and what they went through in intensive care. But there, yeah, I did come across two people who did have unpleasant experiences, and one of them in particular was quite traumatic as well, you know, and it did frighten her a lot, and she didn't want to talk about it. So unlike the others, where they wanted me to go back and talk to them again and again, once I'd spoken to her once, she didn't want to open up about it, and she didn't want to speak about it again.
And did you ever find any resistance from the families as well? Because it must have been quite difficult for them sometimes, you know, obviously to deal with the fact that a family member is obviously in a life and death situation. But to be talking about what happens after we die, it must have made the family sometimes quite uncomfortable, especially if it challenged any sort of, you know, long-standing beliefs that they may have held.
Yeah, well, in fact, what I found was that the family found it quite a relief that they had someone to talk to, because they were trying to discuss it with the family, but the family didn't know how to respond. They didn't know how to help. They didn't know what to say. So, of course, if I was there able to talk to the patients, they were really quite happy. So it was, I was generally very welcomed by the family as well. So
So in a way, I can imagine that you were sort of a conduit, or a kind of journeyman, ferryman type sort of role, because you're facilitating them from something that is impossible really to sort of make sense of. But you were listening, reflecting, and trying to calm as well. Obviously, as a nurse, that's obviously part of the territory, but in a way that is outside the remit or the scope of most people, because, you know, hospitals, mercifully, I've spent very little time in hospitals in my life, but, you know, they're not very nice places for obvious reasons, and obviously one wants to get out of them as quickly as possible. Yeah. But in your case, would have been dealing with patients who didn't survive the period there. And I'm interested in the role that that the patients had on you personally. And was that sort of representative? I mean, do you find that many of your colleagues were always sort of finding that, you know, you have to have a line somewhere because you're dealing with something so traumatic? And in that sense, were you doing something that was sort of unrepresentative in terms of your profession?
Yeah, I think it was initially, but I think because I was doing the research and I was had to inform my colleagues about it as well. So I had to do some teaching sessions to describe what I was doing and everything. Mm. And I think they were quite intrigued as well. And what I found is my colleagues are really quite interested and helpful and very supportive of the research as well. So whereas previously, if a patient had said something to one of my colleagues, they might not have taken it seriously, or they might not have acknowledged it in the way that they did. But if they did come across patients who they thought might have had such an experience, they then let me know and they say, you need to go and speak with this patient. Or they told the patient about my research and said, oh, I'll tell Penny to come and have a chat with you. So they were really helpful in that respect. So, and that's the thing, I think it's incredibly important that as nurses we recognize these experiences, because in the evidence-based profession that it is so easy to kind of mistake these experiences for some sort of hallucination or some sort of delirium or perhaps delusion. So it's really important that nurses are aware of the experiences and that they're able to recognize them and that they're able to support the patients who report these experiences, and they can support the patients simply by validating the experience for them and saying, you know, you're not alone. Other people have had these experiences. They are quite common, but people don't know how to understand them or make sense of them. Just a simple response like that can make such a difference to the way the patient processes that experience.
Yeah, because it's, and that's the interesting bit, isn't it? Because when you're dealing with theoretical cases, that's one thing. But when you're, you know, I mean, people don't normally, you know, choose to go to hospital. They don't choose to be ill. And therefore, you don't then expect something like this is going to happen. And I guess that the worst thing, and it reminds me of that, the Jodie Foster film Contact, you know, when people don't believe you, or they say, oh, that there's another explanation for it. And you say, but I know what I experienced. And you know, if I was in your position, maybe I'd say the same thing. But, you know, but you at least validate the fact that I had something which I can't make sense of, but don't dismiss it because it doesn't conform to your worldview.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is the important message that I want to get across to nurses as well. You know, I think it's incredibly important that they validate these experiences, no matter what their perspective is, whether they believe it's a hallucination or not. It's important to acknowledge it and to validate it for the patient, because it's the patient who has had that subjective experience, not the caregiver.
Yeah. And how did you end up doing the PhD then? How did you get in touch with Paul Badham?
Well, when I became obsessed with near-death experiences and death, I started reading books everywhere. Wherever I went, I had a book about death in my hand. And one of the books that I'd read, Paul Badham had written a chapter in it. And at the end of the chapter, it described that he was director of the MA in death and immortality. And I thought, oh, wow, they do a course on this. So I wrote to Paul Badham, because it was in the days before email. And so I wrote him a letter and I said, I'm really interested in your course in death and immortality because I work as a nurse. And I thought, because I didn't know Paul at the time and I didn't know his background, I thought, I won't put that I'm really fascinated with near-death experiences in case he thinks I'm a bit weird. So I wrote that and I asked him for details of the course. And about 6 weeks later, I got a reply. And he mentioned in that, would you be interested in near-death experiences? And I thought, oh, my goodness, I couldn't believe it. So I phoned him straight away. And he said, OK, well, do you want to make an appointment to come up and see me? And I said, OK, great. He said, how about next week? Well, I was working nights, so I wouldn't have been able to go up for a whole week. And then after that, I was going on leave for 2 weeks. And I couldn't wait all that time. So I said, how about this afternoon? So literally within that morning of receiving the letter, I was sitting in his office about 3 or 4 hours later discussing potentially doing the PhD.
Yeah, and that must have been for you. I mean, it's like having a second career, I guess. But this was one that really complemented the original one. And how did the path change for you? Because I suppose being able in doing the PhD, which obviously was unexpected for you in the sense that it wasn't something that you would have expected to do. How did that completely change your outlook? Obviously, specifically on the study of death, but also more generally, just in terms of the new lens, the new framework that you had for conceptualizing all of this.
Well, it completely changed my life. It completely changed the way I live my life as well. So it made me rethink everything. And it was like I'd taken off these blinkers and all of a sudden life was not what I'd thought it was before. And it just made me appreciate everything as well. So I think being in touch with the patients and hearing the patients' perspectives and the in-depth study of it just gave me a completely different understanding of life and the way I lived it. So I was more appreciative of everything I had in my life and, you know, really living in the moment. It taught me to live in the moment as well and not to worry. And it was just the whole time I was doing that research, I was in that state of flow and it was just felt amazing the whole time of it, you know, and I was just totally consumed with it, but also really being present and living in that present moment and appreciating everything I had in my life.
Yeah. And in terms of, you know, meeting all the other PhD students and the other sort of research that was going on, I mean, did you sort of find that you were sort of really tapping into a whole network of research, which you were in a unique position to change?
Yeah, it did. And I think because I was kind of not really, although I'd meet up with the MA students quite a lot, I still felt quite isolated in a way because I was just doing this at a distance as well. So I'd go to Lambda when I had work to show Paul or if there was something going on as well. So I did feel quite isolated. But when I was in Lambda to then to, you know, be in touch with the other students who were also doing that sort of research as well, it was really great. It felt part of a community there as well. And so that was really wonderful. I loved it. I loved going to Lampeter. It was really, really helpful.
And one of the things that I did in the years up was I did that MA in the mid-90s. And then I teach a course called Death and the Afterlife. And because my own PhD was in film, it's kind of a crystallization of all of these interests. So I look at the way filmmakers, as well as obviously theologians, look at near-death experiences. And is that an area that you sort of delved into at all in terms of the sort of cultural representations of near-death experiences?
Not really. I suppose it's quite difficult as well with regards to film to kind of really encapsulate everything that near-death experience means to people. So it doesn't always get the meaning across in the way that it sets out to, I don't know. I think it's quite difficult with film because they're such unique experiences, but they also follow the pattern. So you tend to see them represented in that typical way of the light and things like that. But it's quite unique to people as well. So I think it doesn't always capture as well as it could do.
Yeah, because what I found thought was really interesting is, and I think I was watching with my students a few clips from the film called Dragonfly, and there was on the extra features, there was an interview with a lady who had this near-death experience, and I think she had it in the 1970s. It might even have been the year I was born. So this was going back many decades, and this apparently was the driver for the filmmakers, and that was the bit, that was the pivot that was really interesting, because obviously the filmmakers have a lot of creative license, but it's drawing on that very personal testimony, but using those familiar tropes, and in that sense, when you encountered those and the sort of the different tunnels and the Raymond Moody work and so on, did you find that intersected and matched your own experience of what your patients were going through? Was it like giving you a theoretical framework with which to deal, or did you find in some cases that that the patients whose testimony you were collating didn't sort of match the paradigms that we were taking for granted?
Yeah, they did. You know, people did describe tunnels, but they described them perhaps in different ways as well. So one man kind of described it like going through like a corrugated sheets and all those around them. So it was the same thing, but sort of slightly differently described. What I did find was that very often, like Raymond Moody portrayed that in his findings, that people were welcomed by their deceased loved ones. And I was quite surprised that what I found with my the relatives who greeted the patients who described their experiences, some of them described them as being angry or shouting at them for being there. Like, what are you doing here? You shouldn't be here. Or another man met his friends and they were like, you were not here now, get back there. They were sort of like that. So it was a slightly different thing where they had communications. Not all of them. Some of them were greeted by their deceased relatives, but some of them, there were quite a few of them who were quite angry as well or hostile towards them.
And were they always deceased as well? Because that's one of the strange episodes. I remember Paul Badham always referring to examples where, or maybe somebody had died, but the patient couldn't have known that they died, and then they have a near-death experience, and the person's in it, and so that, you know, so that could be used to some sense that they're seeing somebody who has died, then, and they didn't know that they died. Then that shows the validity of the experience. But in some cases, I think there have been cases of people who haven't died who are also part of this tapestry. So there's a lot to unpack.
Yes, there is. I did have one patient who saw one of her dead relatives, but next to one of the dead relatives was a living relative as well. But then there was also a case of a patient who had deteriorated during a night shift. We called his family in, and they had been there for a while. His condition stabilized. So about 4:30 in the morning, they said, oh, we're going to go home now to have a sleep. We'll come back in the morning. So once they'd left, the patient kind of got some energy from somewhere, and he was sitting up and he was smiling and he was gesturing to people who we couldn't see. But he was really happy, looked really peaceful and very calm, very, very happy to see whoever he was conversing with. So when his family had returned in the day, he'd said to them, you never guess who was here in the night. He described his mother being there who had died, his grandmother who has died, but also his sister. And he said, what's she doing? Why was she with them? And he didn't know, but his sister had actually died the week before. And the family didn't want him to know because they didn't want it to set back his recovery. So that's quite an interesting case as well. You know, he actually saw someone he didn't know to be dead at the time.
Yeah, although, of course, that must have rebounded. I mean, that must be horrible, because the family were obviously thinking that they were doing the best for him by not telling him that that his sister had died. And then he sees his sister in a near-death experience, and that must have been, you know, especially baffling.
Yeah, that's right. He, you know, he didn't understand it, so the family had to explain to him then, you know.
Yeah, and another thing as well is that, you know, I always remember with Paul Badham, and because these days, you know, Richard Dawkins is the sort of the person who puts forward the materialist case. But Susan Blackmore was the figure that we were always looking at with Paul Badham, and they were the sort of, you know, diametrical opposites. And the arguments that are always used from the other point of view, you know, is that, oh, you know, it's a lack of oxygen in the brain, or, you know, there's all sorts of neurological sort of explanations that can be given. But was that your finding? Because obviously you were dealing with patients, you would know if they were dead or not. So rather than the speculation, oh, they weren't really dead, you'd know from a clinical point of view. So was that something that you felt that you were able to use as a retort to some of those more materialist arguments?
Yeah, some of the patients didn't actually die. They were just critically ill and very close to death and unconscious. But some of them did have. So there was a difference then with patients. When I focused on just the ones who'd had a cardiac arrest, the percentage of the experiences actually went up. So it was quite high. It was quite prevalent. There were about, I think it was 7 out of 39. So it was about 12% of patients who'd had a cardiac arrest remembered and recalled. So they had been clinically dead for a period of time. But, you know, it's hard to kind of scientifically verify it as well. And I think the important thing for me is that these experiences happen. So whether they can be attributed to neurophysiology or not, I think it's really, really important that we acknowledge them as a very valid phenomenon and experience that happens for people, and it gives meaning to their life as well. And if you look at research into end-of-life experiences, for example, Dr. Christopher Kerr, who works in hospice now in Buffalo in America. He's just done some really fascinating empirical work on end-of-life experiences, and he talks about how important these experiences are because they give meaning to patients' lives, and it's important that we take them on board and that we do acknowledge these as very valid experiences for patients, you know?
Yeah, and how different from, you know, the 1970s when it all started, because I was talking to another of Paul's PhD students for my most recent interview, and it was interesting because back in the 70s, this was always seen as a bit cranky, you know, when Paul was doing his own PhD, and the same with John Hick as well, with all this sort of stuff on dualism, you know, it was sort of thought to be against what the establishment of the day was allowing us to see. So anything on mediumship and seances and near-death experiences was just seen to be something that perhaps stretched the elastic as far as what the scholarly community could accept. But by the time I did my work in this area in the 90s, it seemed, you know, it was seen as perfectly reputable and really a religious experience. And of course, Lampeter housed the Religious Experience Research Centre. So in that sense, it felt that within just a couple of decades, this was, you know, there was a real sea change in what was scholarly, you know, able to be investigated.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think we're kind of at a later stage with regards to nursing, because that's where I'm working now and drawing from that. Yeah. And it's very difficult to find acceptance for this sort of work and research. You know, it's very much they need to see the empirical evidence. They need that evidence base, which is incredibly important, but also don't overlook these incredibly important subjective experiences that are a part of the dying process as well. And that's something that we don't understand. We don't understand the dying process as well as perhaps we could. And I think now that empirical research is being done, like the work of Christopher Kerr, for example, it's building on work that's already been done by Osis and Harrelson. They did a study back in the 1970s on deathbed visions. But now there's more and more work coming through, and I hope other researchers are going to be inspired to follow on with this work as well, because it's incredibly important and it's something that's going to happen to all of us. We're all going to die at some point. And, you know, I don't want to be kind of looked after by people who don't understand anything that I might be experiencing subjectively.
Yeah, and it's worth perhaps looking as well at the role that you've played in transforming others, because I know you've done lots of, you know, obviously through your book, you've done lots of talks and tours. And I think I always, I think I was in touch with you briefly a few years ago, and you were, you had been, or maybe I came across something on YouTube, but you'd been travelling, I don't know, around the world, or you'd certainly been, you know, talking about your work. So you know, what has been the, I mean, obviously, we've already covered the fact that when you did this in the late 90s, when you started on this journey, you couldn't have imagined where it would lead. But what about the PhD and beyond in terms of the impact that you have made in your findings?
Yeah, that took me by surprise, really. Ever since I've been doing the work, I had a lot of attention that I didn't anticipate ever happening, you know. So I'm really, really shy person, and to speak publicly for me is a massive big deal. But it's something I really had to get used to as a result of doing the research, because I was contacted by so many people wanting to know more and asking me to do talks. And then when my book came out, The Wisdom of Near-Death Experiences, it was serialized in a national newspaper as well. And when I got the call from the publishers to say they're going to serialize it, oh my gosh, my heart went. I thought, oh my gosh, how is this going to be received? But the article that was written was really sympathetic, and it provoked a huge reaction. And it was published on a Saturday morning, and by 10 o'clock in the morning, I had about 200 emails, and I looked on the website as well of the national newspaper that it was published in. They had something like 500 comments online, and by 6 o'clock in the evening, there were thousands and thousands of comments. And so instead of it being just one article, it was serialized then for another 4 or 5. It went on for the whole of the next week as well. And as a result, I was just contacted by people from everywhere, just wanting me to do talks, wanting me to do interviews with them. And I couldn't keep up with all the requests. So the publishers had to give me a PA to organise my diary for me. It was phenomenal.
And it's so funny, isn't it? Because you one never knows what what's going to tap a particular nerve. Mm. I mean, I suppose the stuff I do on nostalgia, I think, you know, that's something that there's a film out called Reminiscence at the cinema now, which sort of trades on that whole sort of theme. But I've never had the extent of the sort of interest that you've had with your work. And do you think it was because of the fact that you're a nurse, and rather than someone who's written a book based on other people's testimony, do you think that what really worked is because you have a very, you so obviously have a very unique way into this, because you must have been a dream PhD student for Paul and for the department, because you were kind of almost like corroborating the very things that up to that point we'd all been, you know, speculating about through the words and the research and the studies of others.
Yeah, I think it's the topic as well. You know, it's something that really captures the imagination of the public, and it's something of relevance to everyone. And when you start reading about it, even if you're sceptical, it can start you thinking about things as well. So I think perhaps when it starts to get out there in the public and there's a lot of debate about it, people want to know more about it. It raises that interest, and people think, oh my gosh, I remember, you know, my relative having something similar like this, or I know someone else who's described this to me. I never took it seriously before, and all of a sudden people are thinking back and relating it to people they know who've had these experiences as well. So I think it's because it's of relevance to all of us, and possibly as well, yeah, because I was a nurse as well there at the time, talking to these patients.
Yeah, and it's probably worth asking as well, because obviously you've, although you haven't changed careers, you've in a way had changed the contours and the parameters of what you do. but going back to the time when you became a nurse, what inspired you to enter the profession in the first place?
I don't know, really. I think, I don't know. I'd always wanted to be a doctor, I think. So I'd always wanted to do patient things. But then I failed my A-levels at the time. Well, I passed one of them, I think. But I thought, what else can I do now? What can I do that's something similar? And the best thing I ever did was be a nurse, without shadow of a doubt. Oh, it was amazing. And the whole of my training, I loved, and I learned so much from being a nurse, and, you know, then working in different areas after I qualified and then settling in ITU. And I think, I don't know, it was just the perfect career and perfect opportunity to do this kind of work as well. And I think if I hadn't been a nurse, I'd never have done that research. If I had gone on and been a doctor, I would never have done that research, perhaps, you know. So, absolutely the best thing I did.
Yeah, and it's funny, isn't it? Because there's always that sort of talk of meant to be and serendipity and synchronicity and all these sort of things, and which ironically mirrors the very stuff that is studied in near-death experiences. The fact that all these, you know, I always remember Paul Baden giving this example of how, you know, you might be thinking of somebody that you haven't seen in years, and suddenly the phone rings and it's that person, and you think, oh, you know, that there's more to it than being a coincidence. There must be, you know, we're tapping into something that we don't quite understand. But it sounds as though in your own sort of personal life there was that sense in which you were on a journey without knowing that you were on the journey, and almost as though, you know, you had to do and have succeeded in doing exactly what you perhaps never set out to do, but which perhaps, you know, looking back, must feel like some sort of design.
Yeah, it does. When I reflect on it, I think, oh my goodness, it's like it was all meant to happen. And I can remember, you know, being quite upset when I failed my A-levels. I knew I wasn't going to pass them, because all of a sudden going out partying became more important than studying at the time, you know. And I was quite upset, and I thought, oh gosh. And then I reflect back, and it was perfect, you know. If I hadn't done that, I wouldn't have gone into nursing, perhaps, and, you know, the rest of my life wouldn't have happened as it did. So it was all like, it was all part of some great perfect plan.
And something, because obviously we're looking at nostalgia, just because I'm guessing that you're from Swansea originally.
Yeah.
So, do you have any particular sort of memories from growing up in Swansea? Anything? Because I love Swansea. It was always I think I saw you once, because I used to. It was a bit. I remember outside the shopping centre, the Quadrant, because I used to go there to watch films, and I used to feel a little guilty, because I'd always say, oh, because it's part of my PhD. But it's like, but you'd go anyway. Well, I suppose I did the PhD in film, because I was developing this interest in film, because I could see how it dovetailed with my work in theology. But I suppose it's sort of, you know, I would have done that anyway. So, of course, I would always sometimes bump into people and they'd be like, oh, you're going to the cinema again and again. And but in your case, sort of growing up in Swansea, what was that like growing up in that part of beautiful part of the world?
Yeah, it's great. You know, we're right on the coast, so we've got the beaches close by. Everything is there. You know, I used to go into the shopping centre because it used to be very vibrant. It's not anymore. There's hardly any shops open. It's very, very different to what it used to be. But there's new developments coming in now, a lot. But gosh, what do I remember most about Swansea? I think I always remember spending a long time down the beach and down the Gower. You know, that was something that I grew up with a lot, going surfing a lot, and something I haven't done for a few years now. But, you know, that was, good times down on the beach. That was important for me.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there are always, I think everyone has like a go-to place, because I live really close to the seaside, because I'm in Canterbury, and you know the coast is no more than sort of, you know, 10-15 minutes away from where I am. But it's interesting that it took me many years, maybe because I didn't drive at first, before I sort of really took advantage of that. And Swansea was always the place, because I only really got to know it when I went to Lampeter, because I'm from Cardiff originally, which is hardly far away, but that was the nearest place to go to the cinema. And what I used to find, And I went back there. The last time I was in Swansea, I think, was in, actually, maybe it had been 2019, but I remember walking along the beach in 2018 and thinking, this is a city centre with a beach that's just 5 minutes away, but there's nobody on it, even in the summer, and beautiful sandy beach. And I thought, why is that? You know, it's almost as though, and just for a moment, you always imagine that, you know, nobody else has found it. Everyone else is in the shops or wherever they may be. But Swansea seemed to have everything, had the cinema, had the shops, had the marina. And it just kind of seemed to me to have all the sort of the ingredients that sort of made a city just perfect to visit, if not indeed to live in.
Definitely. And saying about the beach now being quite empty, it always traditionally has been quite empty in recent years, but since COVID last year, for example, and now, it's really heaving down there, that beach. It's like you're abroad sometimes. You go down onto the beach and it's full of people. So it shows that, you know, people are not going away, just spend time on the beach.
And as we start to wrap up, Penny, I've got a few more, I always call them philosophically based questions, but I'm never sure that they are, but everything we've discussed so far is philosophically based. But are your memories, as you survey your life and career, and I think you've already answered this really, but would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, you know, definitely the best thing I ever did was be a nurse, do my research. Definitely, you know, that was just, has given me such a different understanding on life and how I live my life, and then where it's leading me. So I've just, you know, in the last 2 years, I've just got initially I worked in the Department of Adult Continuing Education, where I did my own, taught my own modules on science, spirituality and health, and then exploring the mind and consciousness for the part-time degree that they offered. And then that department closed down, sadly. And so I then got a job in the nursing department. So I've been back teaching nurses again. So it's like I've come full circle as well. And I'd never set out to do that. I'd never set out to become an academic. It's just the way that everything progressed. Yeah. And so now I've got this opportunity where I can hopefully educate nurses about these subjective experiences that patients might report to them.
And the next question that I always ask, the sort of follow-up to that one, is whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. And I think there's an interesting twist on that in the light of what we're talking about in relation to death, because effectively I could reframe that question about whether you could be nostalgic about people's encounters with death, because death obviously is a terrifying thing. But also, as we know from the testimony of people who've had near-death experiences, there can also be something very not welcoming. What's the word I'm looking for? Something quite, in some cases, able perhaps to give people a sense of serenity. And so in that sense, you know, to be nostalgic about something like that might seem a paradox, but it may also be something that kind of fits.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so certainly patients who are at the end of their life and they start to have visions and things like that, initially these visions sometimes might be quite sort of negatively perceived, and that they don't want these people here, they send them away. But then the dying person makes peace with that, and you can see that progress in as they approach death. And then when they as they're approaching death, they become very peaceful, very serene, you know, and they do tend to have a very peaceful death as well. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I suppose in your case, because obviously I used that concept of counterpoint earlier, but I'm guessing, I mean, I suppose for me, film, although it's also been the research, is also something that I'm passionate about, and the same with radio and music. But is there anything for you as well, maybe music, the music you grew up with, or the films you may have watched, or whatever it may have been, theatre, pantomime, anything like that? Is there anything from childhood particularly that you sort of still, that there's still a big part of you, that you, maybe when you're driving in your car or something, that you listen to, and that sort of makes the journey, the commute, even more special?
Yeah, going back to 80s music, I bought one of the, I found all of my vinyl records stored up in the attic, and I bought a new record player, so I've been playing my records, and I listened to it in the car as well. Yeah, definitely the music from the 80s.
Yeah, and it's funny, we were talking about, Meant to Be a moment ago, because I used to record lots of stuff off the radio, and I digitized it a few years ago, so it's got bits of the presenters' voices, and a lot of those people have died, so at the time, you know, people would always say, oh, well, if you're recording off the radio, you know, you want to sort of stop the recording before the DJ starts speaking. In my case, it's the opposite, because having those 3 or 4 seconds of speaking gives it a context, and I can in some cases even date it, you know, say that was, you know, mm-hmm. April 1992, or whatever it may have been, based on the information that's given. But I always find that really interesting, because we all carry with us, I certainly do, and through those music tapes, which I listen to on a constant loop in the car, you know, the stuff that I recorded. But it's always interesting, isn't it, how, and particularly with my own children, you know, always, you know, seem to sometimes despise the music I listen to, because it's not their generation. But there's something that's so precious, and it's quality proof as well.
Oh yeah, definitely. Another thing that I always remember is listening to the charts on a Sunday night.
Yeah. Well, I used to write them down, and of course it's funny, because these days it sounds, you know, so quaint, you know, why would you write them down? Because these days you can just get anything online. In fact, you can get anything online. But in those days, I thought, if I didn't capture it between 5 and 7 on a Sunday with, you know, Bruno Brooks or whoever was presenting
it,
then I would, you know, I'd miss it. And then at school the next day, the exciting thing in the playground on the Monday morning, we'd all be comparing our, you know, my favourite record went up 7 places and it might be number 1 next week, and then somebody else has gone down 14 or something, you know. So but that was the, and I think there's something missing now, because in those days radio felt like a really good way of bringing people together, and I think that although there is still live radio, I think my own children, you know, will watch YouTube and all sorts of things, where it's all, you know, they're not into live stuff in the same way, and there was something about that 5 till 7 chart on a Sunday which kind of gave you this sort of sense of, you know, even if you didn't like the record that was playing, there was the hope that your favourite one would come up next. Just a couple more questions, Penny. Are you in touch with many friends from your past?
Yeah, I think not as many, really. Well, I guess they're always there when you might bump into them, you know, if you're out and about, and they're there. But I do keep in regular touch with my oldest friend from school. Yeah, I met her when we were 7. We sat next to each other. She just joined the school. She came and sat next to me, and she's been my best friend ever since.
Oh, that's great. And even during lockdown, did you find alternative ways to stay in contact?
It was quite nice. I quite liked the solitude, to be honest with you. It was good for me. I really enjoyed it. But yeah, you know, WhatsApp and, you know, Zoom has been great for keeping in contact with people. Yeah.
And you just made me think of something as well, because you're right. Because when I went to Lampeter in the days just about before email, or before, although email existed, I don't think I knew in 1991 that email existed. And you know, I'd always be writing letters. But there was something exciting that you send someone a letter, and, you know, every morning you'd be waiting for the post to come. And then, you know, before school or, you know, whatever, wherever you were going, and then getting that letter. And if it didn't come, then you'd wait for the next morning. But these days, you send something on WhatsApp and you might be really busy and you haven't got time to reply. Then you see those dots, and then and you know the person is replying, but you're like, oh, no, you know, but savour it till later, you know. And that's the thing as well, I think, that's missing from those days. The fact that sometimes you can have a bit too, you know, you can have everything at once. And I think some of that anticipation, which we lived with all those decades ago, perhaps it seems now to be something that perhaps, you know, we were missing.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, a friend of mine wrote me a lovely letter. It's the first time in ages I'd had a letter. You know, it was really nice just to get that letter in your hand. It
Yeah.
was really nice. Yeah, everything's at our fingertips now. We expect everything right on time, don't we? You know,
Yeah.
but
Uh,
yeah.
and, and, and my very last question, Penny, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
At this point in time, I'm a looking forward kind of person. I don't know what the future holds, but it's the anticipation of not knowing, I guess, isn't it? You know?
Yeah. Well, Penny, it has been remarkable and wonderful to catch up after so many years and to share our mutual interest in near-death experiences. And I'm sure my students will be really excited when I next teach my Death in the Afterlife module that we've had this chance to catch up. So thank you for being my guest this week.
Oh, you're welcome, Chris. Really lovely to see you again.